This is Derek Frost from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Triangle Business Journal. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. And we start on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal, where the headline is 2013 Business Person of the Year. And the entire front page is a large picture of Scott Wingo, the CEO of Channel Advisor. And then the related articles are inside the Triangle Business Journal with the headline, Young Gun, Wingo's Passion for Sales, Market Acceptability, and Entrepreneurism Earns Him Top Business Honor. And this article is written by Lauren Onsorge with a dateline of Morrisville. The business person of the year doesn't look very businesslike, hurling a ball via lacrosse net across a long corridor of open desks. It's just a typical day for Scott Wingo. It's before 9:30 a.m., and fetch is a morning ritual for the 44-year-old CEO of Channel Advisor, a ritual that hasn't changed, even though a lot around here has. Kit, the blue merle border collie, that's the same age, 6, as youngest daughter Rory. They talk to each other, he jokes, darts past the standing sales staff, and Wingo waits for him to return, ball in tow. The same open environment, the same attitude as when he launched the company in 2001, the same drawings decorating his walls, and even the same life-size Star Wars models that have always dotted the office. Think Yoda and Han Solo's frozen form in carbonite, with a few recent additions, reminding Wingo of the celebrating he did via eBay when he sold his first startup, Stingray Software, to Rogue Wave. But thanks to a successful public offering that raised more than $80 million in 2013, the world is looking at his company, the third in the serial entrepreneurs lineup after AuctionRover.com and Stingray, in a whole new way. Wingo's business acumen to take a fledgling technology company from an also-ran to a local online tech powerhouse, and his interest in working with the entrepreneurial community to create a solid business foundation, made him the Triangle Business Journal's 2013 Business Person of the Year. Doubled in value. The company offers investors an attractive growth acceleration story, writes Raymond James analyst Terry Tillman in a recent research note. For a company whose products rely solely on connecting retailers to outside platforms created by industry giants such as Amazon, eBay, and Yahoo, it's more than some may have expected. The company, which creates a dashboard for e-commerce retailers looking for an easy way to manage and sell their wares on platforms such as Amazon and eBay, launched on the New York Stock Exchange in May, trading for $14. In the month since, stock peaked at $41.25, currently trading for about $40 a share. But Wingo insists he tries not to be obsessed with the stock price, nor does he worry that the uptick in price will alienate buyers who have been with them this long. We just do our jobs, he says, motioning to the desks. Channel Advisor's market value is nearing $900 million, up from about $320 million when the company went public earlier this year. But make no mistake, the company has some ways to go toward profitability. Through 9 months of 2013, it lost $12 million on $47 million in revenue, primarily because of its sales and marketing costs that have ballooned to $26 million in 9 months, up $8 million from the same period last year. But for now, Wall Street seems to acknowledge Wingo's e-commerce firm's strategy. The firm needs to spend money to make money. The company, which has expanded into a second building at Ariel Center Parkway, nearly doubling its footprint to 70,000 square feet, has also penned new partnerships this year, such as deals to support Shopify and Tesco platforms. In addition to recent global expansions, the company has offices in New York, Seattle, London, England, Limerick, Ireland, Berlin, Germany, Melbourne, Australia, Hong Kong, and San Paulo, Brazil. The company is considering expanding closer to home. With a lease on its Morrisville headquarters that expires in 2016, Channel Advisor is looking at space in Perimeter Parkway that can accommodate a growing headcount. But right now it's just talk, he cautions. Customer is right. Today, Channel Advisor stands at 516 workers, and a growing chunk of that consists of sales staff, The sales and marketing headcount was 259 at the end of September, compared to 185 in 2012. New groups of hires constantly rotate in and out of the Morrisville headquarters for sales training, including a prospecting workshop by Wingo himself. It's that introductory lecture where Wingo really shines, say his colleagues. Wingo prides himself in being approachable and uses that character trait in his day-to-day managing style. The ball ruse isn't just for kids' exercise, it's also an entryway, he says, a casual way to interact with employees. It may be intimidating, he notes, to approach your boss with a problem when you're an entry-level salesperson. But when your boss's dog brings you a ball at 9:30 a.m., that's the perfect segue to a conversation. But Wingo's top priority is the customers. Scott is one of the smartest people I know and is just keenly aware of the market and has a really good sense of the customer, says Chief Operating Officer David Spitz. One of the things I find really impressive about Scott is it doesn't really matter how big we get. He knows that at the end of the day, customers are what drive the business. He just stays very closely in touch with the customers. Business traits. Ed Byman, CEO of Global Value Commerce, can testify to that. Channel Advisor software is a big part of his business platform, allowing his company to sell used golf clubs on Amazon and eBay through its subsidiary, Global Golf. We're an e-commerce retailer only, Byman says, adding that without the ability to manage e-commerce channels, his team's Raleigh warehouse would be a nightmare. We started in 2001 and worked with Channel Advisor very early on. Wingo personally swings by every so often for a visit, asking casual questions such as what systems they're on. We did use Bronto, but decided we could do it in-house, Byman says. And how business is going? Wingo uses the information both to kickstart a conversation and to figure out what Channel Advisor products might work to accelerate what Global Value Commerce is doing. Additionally, these conversations are also a big part of how Channel Advisor innovates. When Wingo sees a need, he personally poses the question to his engineers, and his quizzical nature isn't limited to on-site visits. Wingo, who still performs sales calls, isn't above asking potential customers on the phone what they would like to see from Channel Advisor, even if it's a service not currently offered. And as his employees know, he remembers that he's asked the question. He absorbs a huge amount of information, says CFO John Ball. While Wingo is busy absorbing information, he also is acutely aware that he needs to make his company financially stronger, and one of the first steps he took was to reduce the company's debt levels. In 2012, Channel Advisor entered into a loan and security agreement with Gold Hill Capital, borrowing $5 million. An additional $5 million was borrowed a year ago. The loan agreement, which had an annual interest rate of 10.5%, had Channel Advisor making payments until February of 2017. In return, Gold Hill was granted a security interest in Channel Advisor. On November 26, however, a securities filing shows Channel Advisor paid up early. Under the new payoff agreement, Channel Advisor made an $11.3 million payment, of which $1 million was a fixed prepayment fee. All security interest in and all liens held by Gold Hill with respect to Channel Advisor were released. Wingo will never not be a salesman. By now, his staff is accustomed to Wingo's sales lead emails, penned after one of his random searches on eBay results in a new retailer that falls under Channel Advisor's wheelhouse. They know that he continues to make his own cold calls and visits customers, both potential and current, devoting at least a day a week to outside inquiries. And they also know that he subjects all new hires and flies them in from outposts in London and San Paulo to a workshop on e-commerce math with the PowerPoint presentation he wrote on prospecting. And Wingo says he doesn't plan to slow down. Ball attributes that to his passion for e-commerce. Other people participate in e-commerce, he says. Scott loves e-commerce. Entrepreneur's Corner. Ball adds Wingo is always looking for and reading up on things, both for business and pleasure. He's just kind of a sponge, Ball says. A sponge with a dry sense of humor and a proclivity for YouTube videos. And his company isn't the only effort to benefit from his information well. At least once a week, Wingo meets with area entrepreneurs to share contacts and expertise. He doesn't shy from offering critical opinions, such as questioning the Filter Easy team's decision to drop out of North Carolina State University mid-semester. That's why people like Jason Kaplan, one of Channel Advisor's early investors with Southern Capital, keep giving entrepreneurs his email address. They're a success story for us, Kaplan says. Wingo tries to spend what little time he has left after conference calls and entrepreneurship discussions with his family. And he says the shift from private company to public company is another opportunity for education. The day of the IPO, NYSE, New York Stock Exchange, does this thing where they do a live stream, he says, adding that while the staff at home watched at a special celebration at the Sheraton Imperial in Durham, his family watched in person from New York. It was an opportunity for his teenagers, Sean and Dylan, to learn about the world of finance, though neither have expressed much of an interest in following in Dad's footsteps. And that doesn't bother Wingo. The best part of being an entrepreneur? The rush of seeing everything take off. And he has no doubt that his kids will find success in their own ways. And along with this article, we also have a Channel Advisor timeline. 2001, Channel Advisor is founded, makes deal with UBID to provide merchandise suppliers. 2002, forms an advisory board, signs a deal with Dell Computers Corporation. 2005, Channel Advisor opens its UK office, buys AuctionMaster and SpeedSell. 2005, expands from 19,000 to 50,000 square feet. In 2007, Channel Advisor buys Atlanta competitor MarketWorks. 2008, Channel Advisor launches Buy.com product, buys bankrupt RichFX for $3 million. 2008, Channel Advisor lays off 70 employees. 2009, Channel Advisor reaches profitability, at least in terms of earnings before interest, taxes, and amortization. 2010, hiring surge pushes staff numbers above what they were pre-layoffs. 2012, company pays $150,000 to settle claims that it had pirated software installed on its computers. 2012, contracts with Belk. 2012, partners with Atlanta-based Cabbage and Iowa-based DCI. 2013, the company files for IPO, goes public in May at $14 a share. 2013, Channel Advisor opens its Hong Kong and Brazil offices. And 2013, shares trading at about $40 as of December. And the next section of the 2013 Business Person of the Year articles is called Day in the Life of Scott Wingo, CEO, Channel Advisor. And this is written also by Lauren K. Onsorge. 14 hours, that's how long I tailed Scott Wingo, CEO of e-commerce software company Channel Advisor. It was late November, the time of year when his retail clients are readying for holiday shoppers, and a later Thanksgiving holiday means less time to shop. And that means the numbers matter even more than they did last year. His analysts won't just be the talk of media outlets. It's data his clients can use to ready their 2014 shopping seasons and beyond. A wall of his office is covered in screens with graphs of varying colors. Spiked lines show peak times, what the internet is buying and when, creating patterns for how clients such as Godiva and Belk are utilizing Channel Advisor software. It's pretty cool, he says. Even when he's not in Channel Advisor mode or dad mode, Wingo's in sponge mode. His colleagues say Wingo's always talking about e-commerce, even on his own time. It's that passion and absorption of industry happenings that drives him as CEO. 7:31 to 7:46 a.m., time for school. With daughter Rory and 6-year-old Blue Merle Border Collie Kit in the back seat, and daughter Dylan riding shotgun, Wingo grabs a muffin and backs out of the driveway en route to Ravenscroft School. We pull into Ravenscroft and drop off Dylan. Then Rory and the radio dial switches from Kid Pop to CNBC. Son Sean has driven himself to school. 8:14 a.m., coffee and networking break. We pull into the crowded parking lot at Starbucks, where in addition to ordering a venti pumpkin spice latte, yes to whip, we run into several executives, such as CED Executive Director Joan Seaford Rose. You see everyone here, Wingo says. We're here to see Jason Kaplan, an investor with Bull City Ventures, who often brings entrepreneurs for Wingo to talk to. This week is the team from Filter Easy. 9:04 a.m., time for work. The van pulls out of the Page Road Starbucks parking lot. 6 minutes later, we park at Channel Advisor and walk, led by Kit, into the building. 9:17 a.m., playing with the dog. Wingo grabs a ball and a lacrosse net from in front of his office. Kit knows what to do, darting down the sales floor, but we're interrupted by another sales team member curious about Wingo's Google Glass. There are a lot of British accents today. Wingo explains that it's because the new hires at the London office are here to train. Wingo tosses the ball across the room. He explains to me the purpose of this is twofold. Not only is Kit entertained, but Wingo also has a casual excuse to interact with team members on the floor. This is our warming up area, he says, pointing farther down the office. We'll get there eventually. 9:29 a.m., water time. Water time, it's a ritual, he says, heading to the break room and filling a large plastic container with water for Kit. Kit is then sequestered in Wingo's office so he doesn't bother anyone and seems perfectly content with water and a treat. 9:43 a.m., just popping in. We walk by a meeting his team is having with Google. I'll poke my head in, he says. 10:04 a.m., on the road again. It's back in the car. Today we're visiting customer Global Golf, he explains, adding that he likes to check up on customers from time to time, particularly local clients. These guys have been customers for 5-8 years now, he says. 10:20 a.m., customer tour. We pull into the parking lot of Global Value Commerce, a.k.a. Global Golf, and greet CEO Ed Byman. I always try to ask about what our customers are doing, Wingo says. We hit the warehouse for a tour. 10:51 a.m., time for a Diet Coke. We pull out of the parking lot. With some time to kill, we got to one of Wingo's favorite spots, Chick-fil-A, for a Diet Coke at the drive-thru window. 11:26 a.m., on the road again, part due. We're back in the car. This time, Brad Schomber, Channel Advisor's Vice President of Finance, is driving. We're on our way to Perimeter Parkway to meet Duke Realty execs. 11:43 a.m., meeting with Duke Realty. We meet Ryan Tolan from Synergy Commercial Advisors in the lobby, then move to a boardroom with Jeff Sheehan, Senior Vice President of Duke Realty, Hooker Manning, Vice President of Leasing at Duke, and Jim Tully, Duke's Director of Design and Construction. We're here to see photos of Perimeter Park 3, a possible location for Channel Advisor, as it's expanding and its lease is up in 2016. Since Perimeter Park 3 is in early stages, we'll look at Perimeter Park 2. 12:17 p.m., Perimeter Park inspection. We regroup in a construction parking lot and put on hard hats. Before us is what will be the five-story Perimeter Park 2, where concrete is being poured. There are lots of stairs. We make our way to the roof. This is how high the floor at Perimeter Park 3 will be, Shanahan says, and there will be a view of 540 and signage potential. 1:10 p.m., company potluck. Back at Channel Advisor to check on Kit and play a quick round of ball before hitting the elevator and checking out the potluck his employees hold each year for Thanksgiving. Wingo's favorite potluck item? The potatoes. I like to see what people do with them, he says. 1:30 p.m., Market Watch. For our next meeting, we sit around a conference table with a microphone in the middle. It's time for a radio interview with Market Watch. The topic? E-commerce and the holidays. It's going to be an interesting holiday for online retailers, Wingo says, explaining how this year's shopping season is shorter since Thanksgiving came later. 1:42 p.m., back at the office. Interview over, but his day isn't. On the way back to the elevator, he points to the life-size Star Wars figures that pepper the office, bought from eBay, of course. The first model, a fighter ship, was purchased after he sold his first company, he says. 2:15 p.m. We pile into a technology garage. We pile into communications director Sarah O'Day's car. We're en route to the North Carolina State University's technology garage. Wingo wants to check out the progress of the entrepreneurship program and connect with its entrepreneurs. Wingo typically networks with budding entrepreneurs at least once a week, but today is special, he says. 2:53, entrepreneur meeting. We meet with Tom Miller, director of the garage, one of Wingo's friends and mentors. He got me started on having a dog at work, Wingo laughs. Wingo shakes hands with the entrepreneurs present for the meeting. Sean Maroney, CEO of Betaversity, and Jeff Milburn of HireNC.com. The main event, what Wingo's most excited to see, the 3D printers. 3D printers are going to play a big part in the future, he predicts, but how do you control IP? I think that's going to be interesting. I mean, someday you're going to be able to print your own Nike shoes, he says. 3:36, family check-in. A phone call from his wife, Chris, finalizing the plan for tonight. Wingo confirms that he'll be at Dylan's volleyball practice. 3:47, cold drink time. It's back at the office and to the vending machine for another Diet Coke. He grabs a cup of ice. In South Carolina, we like our beverages cold, Wingo notes. 3:47, PowerPoint and YouTube. Back to the elevator and back to his office, Wingo takes the time to prep his presentation for a training session, pulling up PowerPoint. He does, however, take a quick YouTube break to show me a funny music video that Rory just loves. 4:15, Mr. Mingle. Mingles with the trainees. Wingo's presentation is loaded on the wall. Prospecting tips, tricks and strategies, interactive workshop. The trainee group has about 24 people from around the world awaiting Wingo's lecture. 6:22, back to Chick-fil-A. Wingo walks into the Chick-fil-A for dinner, orders chicken strips, 4-count, ketchup and unsweetened iced tea, grabs Splenda packets. 7:01, a game of volleyball. We pull into the Triangle Volleyball Club for his other favorite activity, watching his daughter Dylan play. And another section, which includes parts of his day, is titled, How to Make Friends with Google Glass. He first pulls them out during a traffic jam on 540, his latest toy, the Google Glass. Red for his team, North Carolina State University. The Google Glass arrived yesterday, says Channel Advisor CEO Scott Wingo. Okay, Google Glass, he instructs, directions to Starbucks. At Starbucks, he's inundated with handshakes. Strangers want to hear about his new toy, and he's only too happy to oblige. They're smaller than I thought they would be, notes a passerby. And at every stop today, whether it's at a stand-up sales meeting or the company potluck, he encounters people wanting to try them on. I am very popular today, he says. For Wingo, the obsession with the latest in technology, check out the Samsung Galaxy Note on his wrist, is long-standing. Just prior to the Google Glass, the toy of the day was the 3D printer in his office. I like gadgets, he laughs. But it's not just about staying up to date in the tech world. It's a great way to initiate a conversation with a coworker. After all, while it might be intimidating to approach your boss about a problem at work, it's much less intimidating to say, okay, when he makes his rounds with the Google Glass, looking for people to try them on. And that's how the conversation starts. For Wingo, tech is just another way to connect. Throughout the day, more than 24 people tried on the Google Glass, and dozens more ogled. I'm making a lot of friends, he says. And now we'll move to the viewpoint page, and we'll read the editor's notebook. And Sugata Mukherjee is editor of Triangle Business Journal. And the headline of his viewpoint column is Why We Chose Scott Wingo as Business Person of the Year. Each year, the editorial staff at TBJ spends quite a bit of time discussing the year's top business stories and the issues or trends likely to become big news in 2014. But the most time is devoted to discussing our choice for the Business Person of the Year. Just as when we began honoring the Business Person of the Year 9 years ago, we started off with scores of names. It took us about 2 hours to narrow the list down to about 20. Reporters and editors discussed the merits of each person and their contributions to the community at large. Among the standout list of 20, we were left with several questions on each candidate that needed additional color and clarification. In the second meeting, the list of 20 was cut down to about 6 names. By this time, we were getting excited. Newsroom staffers were becoming more vocal about certain candidates, and often discussions led to clarity as top contenders started to emerge. Reporters were then assigned candidates and asked to make comprehensive pitches to the selection group, keeping in mind the person's 2013 accomplishments, his or her impact, community impact, local and national if applicable, and the fiscal status of the company the person runs or owns. During the final selection process, we went around the table listening to the amazing accomplishments of our finalists and were convinced we couldn't go wrong with any of them. But Wingo stood out in the end. Why? Certainly not because of the size of his business. Channel Advisor is the smallest company associated with Business Person of the Year selection in recent years, following giants such as Quintiles founder Dennis Gillings, former RTI International CEO Victoria Haynes, and Red Hat CEO Jim Whitehurst. But Wingo has something that few of our previous winners had when they were recognized, a track record of building a company and gaining instant credibility on Wall Street. In less than 9 months, he has taken Channel Advisor from a $300 million market cap to nearly $1 billion. Wingo's insistence in helping the local entrepreneurial community weighed in on our selection very heavily as well. After all, if the successful local CEOs will not lend their hand to the startups, who will? Wingo is what is right in the triangle, a homegrown local tech boy who often acts like an Uber kid when it comes to online retail. His family, including his dog, NC State basketball, and the triangle entrepreneurial spirit. Good man. Good choice. And now we turn inside the Triangle Business Journal to the biz section, a quick glance at Triangle happenings. The headline that starts it off, Ain't No Mountain High Enough. When he's not running the Triangle Rock Club's 2 facilities, co-founder Andrew Kratz, a retired Marine, climbs rocks in his downtime. He recently climbed Yosemite National Park's El Capitan, 3,000 feet straight up a granite rock face for 6 days. He said a challenge like that takes 100% focus with no option but to succeed. One hairy move included a king swing, which required Kratz to run horizontally back and forth across the rock face while suspended by a rope in order to launch himself to another part of the course. Kratz said he had never done it before, didn't know how, wasn't even sure he could, but succeeded. He and his climbing buddy slept on the rock faces. When they reached the top, they had to rappel all the way back down. Kratz spent 10 years in the U.S. Marine Corps, Force Recon, and served as a personal guard for the Crown Prince of Morocco. And we have a section called Power Party from the event. There was a Power Party event. The section is Overheard. The headline, Relationship Status, It's Not Complicated. NC State University Athletics Director Debbie Yao showed her softer side at the TBJ Power Party. When approached by 2 Wolfpack fans, she asked if the couple were married or dating. The couple replied that they were just friends, and Yao said that it was actually better to start as friends. Yao said she has been married for 3 decades and credits the fact that she was friends with her husband before they started dating. And another headline in this section, in ACC versus Big Ten, the weather wins. Biz doesn't often run into Hoosiers at Triangle events, so when Biz learned at a recent TBJ Power Party that Mike Latner, senior principal and director of planning at Raleigh's Klein Design, hails from Evansville, Indiana, the conversation led to the inevitable discussion topic, the weather. While it was in the hills of southern Indiana that Lattner developed a love of the outdoors, he chose the Tar Heel State to pursue his education and career in landscape architecture. North Carolina's climate is not only ideal for plant growth, it's more predictably pleasant than those brutal Midwestern winters. And Lattner didn't even have to give up basketball mania to live here. X Games medalist opened new complex. BMX biking superstar Daniel Durs has finalized his deal to open a new action sports complex in Holly Springs by late January. And Holly Springs businessman Abel Zalkberg is getting in on the action. Zalkberg will be Durs' landlord and an investor in the indoor-outdoor racetrack in the Tradition Trail Industrial Center, says Chelsea Nolander, a co-investor and general manager of the Daniel Durs Action Sports Complex. Durs, a native of Venezuela, took the BMX Park gold at the X Games in Germany earlier this year and will continue his training there. Will continue his training here. Baxter Walker of the Colliers International Real Estate Firm says the park will be open to the public for both BMX and mountain bikers. Fellowship sprinkled with friendly rivalry. At last week's TBJ Power Party at PNC Arena, Biz got a chance to meet some of the list makers up close and personal. And it was a conversation with three real estate agents that stuck out above all else. The trio consisted of Kathy Beecham and Kimberly Conroy, both of Coldwell banker Howard Perry and Walston, and Linda Kraft of Linda Kraft and Team Realtors. Knowing how competitive it is in the real estate space, Biz couldn't resist throwing out a few names that have consistently appeared on the list. Biz will keep those close to the vest just to get the agent's reaction. Kraft had left her purse by Conroy and had begun mingling by that point. After a few quips about the competition, Conroy and Beecham hit Biz with a suggestion for the list. On the top teams list, separate the list into two parts, agents that operate solely within specific communities and ones that don't. Makes sense, something for Biz to ponder. All in all, it was certainly an enlightening conversation into the world of residential real estate. But Biz wonders if Kraft ever got her purse back. Contributing to Biz were staffers Jason DeBrun, Dawn Curry, Amanda Jones-Hoyle, and Cameron Snipes. And now we return to a full-length story in the Triangle Business Journal. The headline on this story, Wood Blast DHHS for Defects Revealed in Audit. This article is written by Jason DeBrun with the Dateline of Raleigh. It's probably safe to say that North Carolina State Auditor Beth Wood and North Carolina Department of Health and Human Services Secretary Aldana Woos won't go on too many dinner dates with each other in the near future. The North Carolina Department of Health and Human Services was already the target of one audit that found problems with NCTRAX, the new computer system by which the state processes and pays Medicaid claims. Then, in a public forum, Wood said that Woos misled state lawmakers when Woos claimed there were no warnings about NCTRAX ahead of its launch. Now Wood has released the results of another audit finding defects in the system, asserting DHHS is unable to handle the problems and saying turnover between the department and its contractor gives the impression of a conflict of interest. To be clear, Wood says she does not have anything personal against Woos or DHHS. We had gotten a lot of requests for us to go in and take this really hard look, she says, and we reported what we found. The department has defended itself. One of the audit findings, for example, points out that there have been 3,273 defects reported by DHHS through November 5. DHHS argues that NCTRAX has outperformed industry averages, citing data from the Software Productivity Research, LLC. The department reports that average defects per function point ratio at go-live for a software system is 0.75 across all U.S. software development projects in the survey. For projects greater than 10,000 function points, such as NCTRAX, The average is 1.67 defects per function point. As of November 5, NC Trax operated at 0.19 defects per function point, which is significantly better than the industry average for a software system of such size and complexity at this stage, according to the department. The department says it has processed 81 million claims and paid out $4.5 billion to healthcare providers since July. While DHHS has a process in place for prioritizing and resolving issues with NC Trax, and over 81% of all unidentified defects have been resolved, we thank the auditor for her recommendations, said Joe Cooper, DHHS Chief Information Officer. It is important to note that the number of defects in NC Trax is significantly less than the industry average for a software system of its size and complexity and do not affect the vast majority of providers, he said. Wood emphasized that more importantly than simply the number of the defects was the severity of those defects, and that DHHS did not appear to have a good plan of how to fix the defects. It isn't about the number, but how quickly are you getting to them, she said, and they are not tracking that information. Another nuance to Cooper's figures is that claims to hospitals have been processed at a higher rate than those to individual providers. But smaller providers are more likely to find themselves in a tight cash flow situation and can least afford a missed payment. Charting weekly claims in August and September, the most recent data available shows that claims to doctors were never adjudicated at a higher rate, at a rate higher than 60%, and in 1 week fell as low as 37%. Claims made to institutions, which are mostly hospitals, were adjudicated at a rate of between 68% and 75%. The North Carolina Medical Society, which represents doctors, has been critical of the new system. The auditor's report confirms our worst fears about NC Trax, says Bob Seligson, the society's CEO. This flawed system has been hurting patients and hurting doctors throughout the state since it went live on July 1. We heard about the problems from our members then, and we continue to hear about them to this day. We hope definitive action will be taken now to fix NC Trax once and for all. On July 1, DHHS went live with NC Trax, replacing the existing Medicaid Management Information System. The system is expected to process and pay more than $12 billion a year in health care claims for more than 77,000 medical providers who serve some 1.5 million North Carolina Medicaid-eligible citizens. The federal government covers about two-thirds of the state's Medicaid costs, but that still leaves $4 billion or state taxpayers more than the state gives the entire university system. NC Trax was designed, developed, and is currently operated based on a $484 million contract awarded to Computer Sciences Corporation in 2008. CSC is expected to serve as the state fiscal agent until 2020. And now we turn to the reporter pages in the Triangle Business Journal. First, we have the page for Amanda Hoyle. Hoyle covers commercial and residential real estate. Her first headline, why isn't the Global Trans Park on Boeing's shortlist of NC sites? Sources in both Charlotte and in Greensboro have confirmed that economic development officials are pursuing the Boeing 777X manufacturing plant that's already in heavy contention across the country. But so far, there's no word whether the Global Trans Park in Kinston would also be in contention. Back in 2004, when Boeing officials were trying to decide where to produce its 7E7 jets, the North Carolina Department of Commerce put together an incentive package worth more than $534 million to lure the plant to the Global Trans Park. North Carolina's bid, however, fell short when the company was offered a $3.2 billion incentive package from its home state of Washington. The proposed Boeing 777X plant would create as many as 8,000 jobs and would be a game changer for whichever community Boeing chooses. When I reached out to Sherman Lupton, Director of Logistics and Executive Director of the Global Trans Park Authority, about a week ago, he said he wasn't aware of any bid to try to bring Boeing to Kinston. "We're aware of what's going on in Washington State, but we've not had a lot of discussion about it," he said. Beth Gargan, a spokeswoman for the North Carolina Department of Commerce, would neither confirm nor deny whether the state was pursuing the project. "We are happy to provide information if and when a project is publicly announced," she stated in an email response. The GTP is already home to one aircraft manufacturer. Kansas-based Spirit AeroSystems employs more than 260 people in Kinston, where it makes parts for Boeing competitor Airbus. Diamond View 3 gets an anchor. With construction of the new Diamond View 3 office building now complete in downtown Durham, the building's anchor tenant, the nonprofit FHI 360, officially opened its new headquarters there on Monday. FHI 360, previously known as Family Health International, is occupying more than half of the 130,000 square foot Diamond View 3 building that's adjacent to the Durham Bulls Athletic Park at American Tobacco Campus. The five-story building, developed by an affiliate of Raleigh-based Capital Broadcasting Company, was built to LEED, L-E-E-D, certification standards for green design, construction, and operations. FHI 360 is moving about 400 employees from its longtime headquarters building on NC 54 in Durham to Diamond View 3. A collection of new restaurants will also be opening in the Diamond View 3 building in 2014, including the Q Barbecue Restaurant by Pitmaster Ed Mitchell and Moe's Southwest Grill. And in our final section on this page, Property Matters, here's a look at a few of the week's top real estate deals in the Triangle. The Harris Teeter Grocery Store Company has purchased a six-acre site near Briar Creek in northwest Raleigh, but it may still be a while before construction of a new store will begin. An LLC affiliated with Harris Teeter paid $1.45 million for the retail lot at the corner of T.W. Alexander Drive and ACC Boulevard, according to Wake County records. A Philadelphia real estate investment firm has bought the two former Sony Ericsson headquarters buildings in Research Triangle Park, now vacant for 3 years, for a price that's about 40 cents on the dollar. Rubenstein Partners of Philadelphia paid $26 million for the Ericsson buildings and 67 acres on Development Drive, according to Wake County records, which is about 60% less than the $64 million that the County Revenue Department values the property for tax purposes. Kite Realty Group, the developer of the new Parkside Town Commons Shopping Center underway in Cary, has secured an $87.2 million loan to fund the project's construction and development. The loan is being financed by the Huntington National Bank of Columbus, Ohio. And now we turn to the page of reporter Jason DeBrun. DeBrun covers healthcare, nonprofits, and sports business. His main article is in a section called By the Numbers. Medicaid enrollment and spending swell to record levels is the headline. North Carolina's Medicaid-eligible population has increased at an average annual rate of 3.4% since 2004, bringing the total enrollment to more than 2 million in the past 2 years. Naturally, spending has increased over that period as well, with the overall Medicaid budget increasing to some $13 billion this year. State leaders are taking a crack at trying to fix the program that provides health coverage to the state's neediest residents, most of whom are women and children. A new advisory panel heard presentations on how Medicaid works in this state, with representatives from the Department of Health and Human Services pointing out problems in how the system manages patients. Consider a person with a mental disability who enters an emergency with liver failure. There are obvious medical needs, but that patient could also have an alcoholism problem, which led to liver problems. Under the current Medicaid system, the mental and physical needs of that patient are divided, and that patient would not receive the holistic care he or she needs, adding higher costs to taxpayers in the long run. Representative Nelson Dollar, a Kerry Republican, sits on the advisory committee. He has been a supporter of Community Care of North Carolina, a nonprofit that manages certain portions of the Medicaid population. CCNC has been credited with saving Medicaid more than $1 billion in a four-year span, but representatives of the organization and others who support the group have said they felt slighted by some of the comments made by DHHS Secretary Aldona Woos and Governor Pat McCrory, who have called for a complete overhaul of the Medicaid system. Dollar supports a plan that tweaks Medicaid rather than completely overhauling the program. The group will meet again in January and at least one more time after that before developing a full set of recommendations to state legislators for the 2014 session. And now we have a section titled, They Said It. North Carolina lawmakers rejected the Medicaid expansion, which President Obama had pushed for in the Affordable Care Act. An analysis published by the Commonwealth Fund, however, shows that rejecting that expansion means fewer federal dollars flowing to this state. The study's authors sounded off on those states that did not expand the program. States that choose to participate in the expansion will experience a more positive net flow of federal funds than will states that choose not to participate. In addition to providing valuable health insurance benefits to low-income state residents and steady sources of financing to state health care providers, the Medicaid expansion will be an important source of new federal funds for states. And that was from Commonwealth Fund study authors Sherry Gleed and Stephanie Ma. Another section is titled Big Number, and that big number is $2.59 billion. Estimated federal dollars that North Carolina will miss out on in 2022 because it has not expanded the Medicaid program. The Affordable Care Act mandated an expansion of Medicaid. However, the Supreme Court ruled that states would be allowed to reject that rule if they so choose. In North Carolina, as in many states led by Republicans, lawmakers decided to not expand the program. The federal government already pays about two-thirds of North Carolina's Medicaid costs and would have covered 100% of the expanded program for 3 years and 90% of the new Medicaid users after that. The study, which looked at how much each state would lose out on in federal Medicaid dollars, was performed by the Commonwealth Fund, a group that has vocally supported the new health law. And in the final section on this page called Sound Off, the headline is, NC's mental health system needs a major tune-up. How North Carolina treats mental and behavioral health patients needs fixing. We have a system where we are not able to treat people in the right way at the right time, says Dave Richard, director of the Division of Mental Health, Developmental Disabilities, and Substance Abuse Services, part of the North Carolina Department of Health and Human Services. Richard hosted the first meeting of a new group tasked with improving mental health and substance abuse crisis services in North Carolina. More than four dozen parties from around the state attended the informal meeting to discuss various problems in the system and propose solutions both for the near and long term. It's important that we go after solutions, not just talk about problems, Richard said at the beginning of the meeting. And now we go to the reporter page of Lauren Onsorge. Onsorge covers infotech, biotechnology, and entrepreneurism. The main headline, Tekelec CEO retires post-Oracle buy. For energetic departing CEOs, there's always a new ball game ahead. 6 months and some change from when his company, telecom equipment maker Tekelec, was acquired by Oracle, its former CEO Ron DeLange is out. DeLange, who joined the then Morrisville-based firm in 2005, says he is officially retiring and that there are no regrets. The waters have settled from an acquisition that he still contends was good for the area, both 6 months ago and today. Why? Because Oracle looks at the Morrisville operation and thinks growth, he says. What he will miss? The people, the technology. It's great technology. With the cash coffers of global giant Oracle, the mobile broadband software firm can really get that technology out there comfortably, and it has been a rocky couple of years for the firm. In 2012, a consortium of investment groups had taken Tekelec private for about $780 million. Tekelec, which provides signaling services for communications companies, had run up $30 million in losses in the 15 months prior, resulting in layoffs and uncertainty at the cubicles. At the time of the acquisition, there were about 600 local employees, and DeLang contends there haven't been layoffs during Oracle's reign. During our conversation, we talk about how some company marriages are good exits for investors, but just aren't good for the area. One example that instantly comes to mind is that of Kerry Yellow Pages maker Dex One, whose merger with Texas-based Supermedia cost the Triangle jobs and a headquarters. And I can't help but think of another Morrisville firm, iContact, sold last year to Maryland-based Vocus. At the time of its sale, iContact, founded by young entrepreneurs Ryan Alice and Aaron Houghton, had 250 employees. A month later, 75 were axed, and neither founder was on the payroll. According to the conversation I had last month with Holly Paul, Vocus's new chief human resource officer, the current headcount nearly 2 years later still pales at 159, though layoffs have ceased and were non-existent in 2013, she says. But DeLang again makes himself clear, the Oracle move isn't just good for Tekelec, it's good for Morrisville, meaning more jobs and more local technology. But he admits that it is hard to find any deal, particularly a blockbuster such as this one, with Oracle. So, what is the formula for being acquired by an Oracle, a Google, a Cisco? It boils down to three things, DeLang says: being number one in your sector, penning profits and demonstrating growth. Everything else is just luck. DeLang says he'd like to enjoy his retirement, but promises he will be busy. In addition to his duties as one of the new owners of the Carolina Hurricanes, DeLang says he's considering private equity investments, but has no specifics. It has been a long career for DeLang, who, prior to his Tekelec tenure, spent about a quarter of a century at Lucent Technologies. And on the reporter page for Dawn Curry, who covers money and small business, the main headline: bridge closure slams Outer Banks economy. Hatteras Island is taking a substantial economic hit with Bonner Bridge on NC Highway 12 closed to traffic. The North Carolina Department of Transportation has closed the bridge for safety reasons due to erosion along the bridge's support columns. Now, 8 villages below Oregon Inlet are only accessible by ferry. East Carolina University Professor of Recreation and Leisure Studies Hans Vogelsong, director of the Coastal Resources Management PhD program, has estimated that Hatteras Island is losing a minimum of $110,000 a day because the bridge is closed. In December, Hatteras Island could see a loss of $3.4 million based on Vogelsong's numbers. This is based on occupancy tax, Vogelsong says. It only reflects spending from visitors, but most structures in those communities are second homes, and over Christmas, you have second home owners that go there. Now they are not as likely to get there. The North Carolina DOT will put just over half of that loss back into the bridge, with a $1.6 million contract awarded this week to Carolina Bridge Company Incorporated of Orangeburg, South Carolina, for emergency repairs on the bridge. First, Dredge Alaska will begin dredging sand from Oregon Inlet to the area under Bonner Bridge, where the erosion caused concern. Then sandbags and 4-foot Ajax will be brought in to support the bridge. Two additional layers of sandbags and Ajax will be placed on top of the first layer. This bridge closure comes just as after bids for construction on the long-awaited Bonner Bridge replacement went out, with construction set to begin in spring of 2014. And in our remaining few minutes, we'll return to the viewpoint page and the guest column The headline, popular view of entrepreneurs as risk takers is flawed. And the writer of this article is Alexandra Kapershik, who is the Fred Cain Career Development Professor of Entrepreneurship and Assistant Professor of Technological Innovation, Entrepreneurship, and Strategic Management at the MIT Sloan School of Management in Massachusetts. At a large established company, several employees get together and hatch a plan for a new business. Eventually, they make the leap, exiting their old firm and launching a venture that takes off and achieves great heights. This oft-repeated tale is usually considered a business success story. Spin-offs have the potential to generate great value. New companies create jobs and spawn new products and services. When the process starts happening at a number of firms in the same place at the same time, business clusters form, spreading prosperity across an entire region. Often overlooked in this rosy scenario, though, is the damage the established firm suffers from the departures of its creative employees. Losing talented people is never a good thing for a company, new or old. When they leave to start new firms, entrepreneurs take their knowledge with them. Because the new venture is usually in the same industry as the established firm, the incumbent tends to be hurt by the new competition. The exodus of talented and creative people from established firms is not inevitable. I have found in my research that one of the main reasons people leave established companies to start new ones is that these employees are stymied in their current positions. They can't see any opportunities to use their creativity. Often they see few possibilities for significant career advancement of any kind. In a study of the mutual fund industry, I found that when employees had the opportunity to launch funds inside their companies, many pursued that opportunity over exiting the firm and starting a fund on their own. In another study, a colleague at MIT Sloan, Matt Marks, and I examined the histories of entrepreneurs who came out of established firms in the speech recognition industry. And we'll start to have to stop there as we run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Derek Frost, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. The program is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast. You can contact us at 919-832-5138. So long until next time.